Thank you. How lovely. Thank you. I'm really delighted to begin tonight's plenary, our only plenary, by welcoming you to the 40th annual conference of the Association for Jewish Studies. It's a tremendous milestone for the organization, and I hope that you'll take the time to look at the poster exhibit that, in essence, documents the origins of our association as a scholarly organization and its evolution over time. It really helps us focus back to a time when our éminence grise were enfants terribles, and it really conveys that very strong sense. It's a time, a 40th anniversary is a time to reflect on where we have been and where we are going, and of course on where we are. It's a time to reflect upon the shape of our profession, the shape of the field of Jewish studies as it has been evolving. And as I look out, we look out, and you look around you, we clearly are a vital, healthy, growing organization with a diversity of perspectives, a diversity of fields and subfields, and it's really a pleasure to be here. I want to thank publicly Kristen Loveland for putting together the poster exhibit, and I know that you'll find it fascinating and really thought-provoking, and it really made me rethink my own personal sense of the history of the AJS and reflect upon even my own lived memory in some different ways. You get a sense of the expansion of our field, and the conference itself, of course, and all of your presentations is what is the strongest evidence of the vibrance, the vitality, and the creativity of this field that we call ours. So now I'm going to take a step on the wild side and at great risk say the following: Chag Sameach and Happy Hanukkah. I hope you will take that as a religious statement, or as an ethnic statement, or as a secular cultural statement, or as a reflection on an exotic custom of a group that you don't belong to. Any of those are fine, but please, Happy Hanukkah to all. Tonight is the first night. We are here at this banquet thanks to a group of sponsors whom you'll find listed in your publication, so please do note them, and we thank them very strongly. We have a wonderful event coming up later tonight. This is the first annual Jordan Schnitzer Book Award that we are presenting. Each year, there will be a book award in two different fields. The award presentation is later this evening at 9:30 in a room called Farragut Square. I do hope you'll join us. It's a major book prize. It's a major event for AJS, and it's a way, again, of honoring creativity and excellence in the kind of scholarly work that our membership does. This year, there are two fields that are being awarded, that is, awards are being given in two fields. One is in gender studies, the other is in Jewish thought and philosophy, and each year there will be a different two fields that are chosen in a four-year cycle. So keep writing and hope for the best for yourselves, and please go to this so you can wish well to our colleagues who have been so honored. And I'm not going to announce it so that we can keep the suspense perhaps a little bit longer. I do want to thank publicly, of course, our executive director, Rona Sharamy, who is back there. Rona is responsible for the smooth sailing of this organization and the many things that facilitate our growth in many directions. And, of course, Rona is helped by very devoted and able and talented staff people. So I also want to thank Kristen Loveland, who I've already mentioned in connection with the wonderful poster exhibit. Kristen did a wonderful history involving archival AJS documents as well as interviews, and she managed to recreate the history of the AJS as many people remember it. I also want to thank Aviva Androfi, who's part of the staff, and Karen Kugel, all of whom in many, many ways we are very grateful for. And of course, I want to thank the members of the program committee and the division heads, the section heads who also make this possible, but of course all of you for coming here and really bringing to us the finest fruits of your labor at this conference. It's a profound learning experience, I think, for everyone who comes here. And I know that we have a few members of the local community who are here, and we're also very delighted to bring Jewish knowledge to the different communities in which we hold our annual meeting. I don't want to have extended remarks because I know you're all interested in hearing the panel that's coming up, so I saved my last thanks as a segue to getting onto the business at hand. I'd like to thank the program chair, the vice president for programming, Marcia Rosenblatt, who has done a marvelous job putting together a diverse and rich and varied and stimulating program in a very labor-intensive and thoughtful job. So thank you very much, Marcia. And I'm going to ask Marcia to come up and introduce this evening's program.
Well, thank you. Now I don't have to thank all the people that helped me do this, the program chairs and the division heads and the program committee and Rona and Kristen and everybody else and all of you. So thank you. I want to welcome everybody to this plenary session of the 40th annual AJS conference. In honor of the 40th anniversary, we decided that instead of asking somebody to give a talk, that we would invite the past presidents to talk about the AJS, to reflect on the AJS and on its conception or inception. I don't know what word is the proper word. It's conception or inception 40 years ago, and on its history and growth and evolution over the past 40 years. And so we have this plenary, Reflections at 40, Past Presidents on the Founding of the AJS and the Field of Jewish Studies. We invited all of the past presidents of the AJS who are alive and well. And only two were unable to participate because they were out of the country. And that was sad because it would have been also nice to have Michael Meyer, who was president from 1979 to 1980 and one of the founders, right, of the AJS, be with us, but he's in Israel now. And Arnold Band, who was president from 1973 to 75, and who was also one of the founders, but he's out of town as well. And then there was one past president who is alive and is reasonably well, but not well enough to travel, and that's Herbert Paper, who was president from 1992 to 1994. Was he a founder as well? Was Herb one of the founders? I don't think so. But all of these people, Michael Meyer and Arnie Band and Herb Paper, extend their best wishes to us all, and they're very sorry that they can't be here. But we are fortunate to have the seven people, who sit before you. We are very lucky to have seven past presidents here to talk and reflect about the AJS. And I will leave the introductions to our moderator, who is the immediate past president, Judith Baskin, who was president from 2003 to 2006. But I will at least name all the past presidents for you and tell you when they were president. There's in order of when they were president, not in the order of how. No, I guess I should do it in the order they're sitting. I'll do it in the order they're sitting. Furthest is Ruth Weiss, who was president from 1986 to 1988. Next to her is Robert Seltzer, who was president from 1995 to 1997. And then Robert Chazen, who was president from 1989 to 1991. And then Larry Schiffman, who was president from 2000 to 2003, followed by David Berger, who was president from 1998 to 2000. And Jane Gerber, who was president from 1981 to 1983, and of course Judith Baskin, who was president most recently and who will moderate this discussion. So she will introduce the presidents more specifically and describe the format, and I will just introduce Judith, who needs no introduction, of course, but she is the head of the Harold Schnitzer Family Program in Judaic Studies at the University of Oregon, and her field is Midrash and Medieval Studies and Gender Studies. That's just only one of the 20 or more than 20 fields in Jewish studies that we have represented here. So it's my pleasure to introduce Judith and the other presidents. Thank you.
In fact, our discussion will take place with the panelists sitting at the table, but I wanted to come up here first both to introduce each of our past presidents who is here with us and also explain to you the way the panel will work and make a few remarks of my own. We have actually the program Vice President Marsha Rosenblatt, together perhaps with Rona Sheremy and Sarah Horowitz, formulated a number of questions, and each of the past presidents was given an opportunity to choose a question that he or she wanted to address. So I will moderate the panel in terms of asking each of the past presidents a particular question, and they will talk about it for about 7 minutes or so. We will try to keep the initial presentations, therefore, to 35, 40 minutes. And then there'll be a perhaps opportunity for people on the panel to respond to what others have said. And then we very much would like to open it up for questions from the floor. Before I introduce the people on the panel, I just also want to say a little bit about my own history in the organization. I first attended the AJS in 1976, kind of frighteningly for me, 32 years ago, when we met at the Copley Plaza after I had just received my PhD and had begun my first teaching job at UMass at Amherst. It was a very different organization from today, of course, first of all, in being significantly smaller and rather overwhelmingly male. And one of the things that's wonderful about tonight is that in the history of the AJS, there have been 4 women who have been president, and all of us are here in the room, Ruth and Jane, myself and Sarah, and certainly back 32 years ago, we never would have imagined even that 4 of us would proceed and that the field and fields of Judaic studies would change so much. My own trajectory in the organization was, as Sarah's in many ways, through the Women's Caucus first, where we took on leadership roles and then were invited to be part of the program committee in terms of initiating a gender studies section area, which actually seemed quite revolutionary at the time, and moving through program section head, program chair, and into the leadership role. Now, of course, a significant proportion of our membership are women, and most of the new scholars in whatever area they're working in understand the significance and centrality of gender as a category of analysis that has to be considered. Again, something we might not have imagined to be the norm 20 years ago. So our panelists... perhaps the first respondent to a question will be Robert Chazen. Bob is the S.H. and Helen R. Scheuer Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies and Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies and History and Director of the Wagner-Skirball Dual Degree Program, Co-Director, Doctoral Program in Education in Jewish Studies at New York University, the one thing that is not down here. His field, of course, is, as we all know, medieval Jewish history. The question that Bob has chosen to address, and he has 7 minutes, is what were the major debates in the field at the inception of the AJS, and how did AJS seek to address them?
From here?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to start with just a couple of observations about the first conference back in 1968. From what I can gather, I'm the only one of the past presidents present who was there. It was a very small group. There were 38 people. It was overwhelmingly people from the Northeast. There were people from elsewhere. But overwhelmingly people from the Northeast. As has already been indicated, there were very few women in that group. And the final thing that I want to mention is that the balance between university, people working in universities and people working in specifically Jewish institutions, which really meant Yeshiva University, Jewish Theological Seminary, and Hebrew Union College, the balance wasn't quite even, but the people working at the seminaries constituted a very, very substantial minority of that first gathering. What were the major issues that in that first year and on into the second year as well? Obviously, part of the concern was simply organizational structure. Something new was being created, and there was a lot of focus on that. Number two, there was a great deal of optimism about the development of the field on university campuses across the length and breadth of North America. And a major concern had to do with the standards for appointments. Would it be possible, the question was, to produce well-trained doctorates, people who could properly represent the field of Jewish studies? There was a great deal of concern that as universities began to gravitate toward introducing Jewish studies, in the absence of well-trained holders of the doctorate, and perhaps even just in terms of the ease of bringing someone onto a campus, that there would be a turn away from academic preparation and simply the utilization of local rabbis. The steps that were taken in those early years were to make the fledgling Association for Jewish Studies a kind of informational slash lobbying agency with universities. There was a desire to get the organization out front and center so that universities contemplating the introduction of Jewish studies would turn to the Association for Jewish Studies. And while the efforts were largely informal, I think arguably there was a great deal of success in that direction. A second concern was to strengthen the cohesion of this phenomenon called Jewish studies. And I remember the notion in those very early years that the AJS conference was going to be an annual opportunity for people to encounter their colleagues in other subfields of Jewish studies that they weren't part of, that the modern historians were going to go to the Bible sessions and the people working in rabbinics were going to go to medieval Jewish history. That was a smashing failure as a result of the success of the organization. I mean, at that point, who knew that there would be as many sets of sessions and that every specific session would have 15 different groups going simultaneously? That was a dream of the early years of the organization, one that was, in fact, not possible to realize. The third set of concerns, going to sound a little bit strange 40 years later, but there was a lot of concern about the relationship of this new academic field to the Jewish community of North America. And there were varying views. Some people argued there should be no relationship at all. Other people argued that there ought to be a relationship. And that's one of the reasons that I started with the demography of that first gathering, the fact that a substantial minority group came from the institutions that were really devoted to serving the American Jewish community, Yeshiva University, JTS, HUC. That had some significance in that discussion, and I think all that has to be said about that is that the issue with the passage of time resolved itself. Every once in a while, there has been a minor flare-up. We kind of heard a reference to it with the multi-form Hanukkah greetings that were given to all of you so that no one would have his or her teeth set on edge. The last thing that I want to say within my allotted 7 minutes is, looking back specifically at 1968, there was enormous excitement and a great deal of optimism about the growth of the field. But as I've said a couple of times around the table here at dinner, no one in the wildest flight of imaginative fancy could have dreamed that the Association for Jewish Studies would evolve into the large and diversified and varied organization that it has become. Thank you very much.
Yes, and just as a point of information, we now have 1,700 members, and we're not yet finished dunning people for their membership dues, and this is really a record. We certainly expect to probably go up to about 1,800, so who would have imagined 40 years ago?
No way.
And I now turn to Jane Gerber, professor at CUNY Graduate Center. Her field, as again we know, all know of us know, Sephardic and Jewish studies with the focus on Spain and the Islamic world. And the question for Jane is, what are the most striking developments you have seen in the field generally and in the AJS specifically over the past 40 years? And I know that you also will incorporate that into general memories of the early days.
Thank you. Actually, I thought, as I considered the context this evening, that it would probably be more meaningful for me to share with you a few of my own recollections of those earlier years. But of course, since I am with colleagues who are historians, I will put in a few historical caveats that... Okay. On September 7th, 1969, 54 scholars convened at Brandeis to the accompaniment of thunder, lightning, and howling winds. I'm not sure, maybe we'll leave it to the theologians among us to tell us whether or not this was a cosmic response to the awesome pronouncement of the formation of the American Association of Jewish Studies. It had that name at first when it was formed. It's hard to imagine today the resistance that greeted the formation of the Association for Jewish Studies at that colloquium. Some Jewish scholars not only refused to participate, but actively opposed the association. Others specified in advance that they would attend the first meeting, but that it be clearly understood that this did not constitute a commitment to join the organization. How far we've traveled since that birth 40 years ago. Let me start with sharing just a few of the recollections that do in some ways relate to the question of the then and the now. Some of these recollections are from chairing the conferences in the mid-70s and then serving as a president. First of all, and I'll try to share them without letting any of the skeletons out of the closet. I promise that I won't do. I hope, though, that they will convey not just the maturation of our society, but also, as Bob said, the exhilaration, as well as some of the naivete, I think, of and self-congratulatory spirit of those early organizational efforts. And those efforts really were very, in some ways, inchoate and pioneering, because I think the attempt to forge a collective voice for the community of Judaic scholars ran up at the beginning against spirits that wanted to be the voice. And so the collective versus the individual voices that existed then was an ongoing tension of the 70s. If we turn for a minute, though, to those first 54 attendees at Brandeis in 1969, I'm immediately struck by the most salient trait of that time. 53 of the 54 were men, and one woman, Lucy Davidowitz, was the female in attendance. And the association was not only skewed this way gender-wise, but it really was a men's club. It really was. There were in-jokes in the sense of there was a paternalism in the society and somewhat of a spirit that the gatekeepers had a desire to keep those gates pretty much closed if you didn't have a certain training that was really a natural training. It was rabbinic training that most of the scholars in Jewish studies had by virtue of that was where you could learn about the Judaic heritage on a higher, more advanced level. But issues of membership went beyond the question of the underrepresentation of the Jews or Southerners or Midwesterners. Much ink was spilled and many hours were spent discussing not just the lofty and very important issues of what were Jewish studies, who were its practitioners, what should its relationship be to Jewish organizations, the criterion for membership, but also the question arose whether it was professional in an academic organization to recite the Birkat HaMazon all together at the end of the banquet. This was a very, very heated question. The very youth of the association also made it insecure and sometimes juvenile. For instance, would the HAS survive if it changed the annual conference date from October to December? Or what would happen if it left Harvard, the Harvard Faculty Club, for a downtown Boston hotel? Or what was the most heated discussion? And what if they left the Copley Plaza altogether? Would that be the end of the whole organization before it even got to its teens? But by 1975, the AGS had entered a precocious childhood, reaching a new state of maturity with the grant from the National Foundation for Jewish Culture for the publication of the AJS Review. And then the worry was, would there be material? The award of a multi-year NEH grant in 1975 resulted in the mounting of 10 regional conferences in a six-year period. And this, by the way, the excitement of that time does come through in the newsletters from the 70s, in which there was a note of astonishment that one can, and I'm quoting, one can set a learned symposium in an astonishing variety of places in this country. Surely, I mean, this was new for AJS. Clearly, the provincialism of the AJS was beginning to be shed by the mid-70s, though, of course, nothing like the international scope of Jewish studies could even have been conceived at that time. But like the annual checkups to the pediatrician, the size and growth and numbers were they were perceived as the barometer of good health. In 72, our membership stood at 200. It was noted with satisfaction, though, that AJS was already a referral, the conduit, for 2,500 referrals for 54 positions that year. By 74, membership had jumped to 700. By 76, we had hit the 1,000 mark. And that was really very, very much a cause of rejoicing. But the excitement of all of this was tempered in some ways by certain burning issues. Who was entitled to obtain our mailing list? This was a very, very important issue. And how much should we charge for it, since it was our main source of income? We didn't always agree. The annual conferences were faulted for being too selective or for not being selective enough. We argued about the degree of deference to be paid to senior scholars from Israel, while our own senior scholars were not adequately honored by our organization. Our teachers, the pioneers of Jewish studies in America, and there were very few at that time, were incredulous when they witnessed our growth. At our fifth annual conference at Harvard in 1973, Harry Wolfson remarked, "If I believed in miracles, I would place this conference in that category." In 1976, we honored the revered teacher of many of us here on the dais, Salo Baron. It wasn't clear, we weren't sure, actually, I wasn't sure, whether I had bestowed a great favor on him by having him, by this dinner tribute we were going to give him, an honorary membership. It took him almost 15 hours to get up to Boston with his wife in the snowstorm. And when he got to the dining room, and this was a man whose own dining room was festooned and covered with honorary degrees from everywhere in the world. And when he got to the HAS dining room and looked out at us, at this crowd, and of course it looked bigger than it was because it had all those garish mirrors in the ballroom there, he sort of sighed for a minute, and he was visibly shaken. He was really visibly moved. And he recalled an address that he had delivered at the Association for Jewish Education in America in 1947, in which he had mused out loud, and I quote, "When we speak about the future of the Jews in the U.S., quality is certainly as important as quantity. I have said it before, but I believe that it bears repetition, that if I were assured today that a generation hence we shall have 100 first-rate scholars, 100 first-rate rabbis, 100 first-rate teachers, 100 first-rate communal workers, and 100 first-rate writers, publicists, and artists, the total number would amount to 500 or 1/100 of 1% of our population. Then I should feel assured, nevertheless, of a great future for the Jews in this country." And the fact that so many of those people out there were not just students, but students already of his students, I think was a cause of great, really very moving to him. But growing pains were typical of the 1970s, and so one or two of the less, I guess, the less exciting or the more interesting quirks that we had that I'll just share. At the annual board meeting, maybe just this final one, in 1974 at the Copley Plaza, a distressing issue was debated at somewhat inordinate length. I might add parenthetically that the minutes from that whole period do not exist. I don't know, they've disappeared, the Watergate minutes. So if you don't hear it here, you might never hear this. The substance of the debate, though, was indicative of the continuing efforts of the HAS, as Bob mentioned, to delineate the boundaries of Jewish studies and the differences between Jewish studies as a tool or vehicle of Jewish identity or communal identity formation, and Jewish studies as a legitimate part of the academy. The issue in 1974 at hand prompted much agitation. A communal program had been launched at the time by the American Jewish Committee called the University Without Walls. Much of the board meeting was devoted to this perceived challenge to the integrity of our field and of our identity. The protracted debate ended with a very solemn, almost like one of the medieval takanot or tshuvot. It says, "It has come to our attention. The board affirms all necessary steps must be taken to revolve with dispatch an intrusion." Remember, this we're talking about an adult education program. "Into the academic community of what is ostensibly an adult education program that is the university without walls. We know better, of course. And so in 1975, representatives of the AJS were sent to New York to meet with the head of this program in this very serious and, you know, very reliable communal organization. And the following agreement was made by the American Jewish Committee. I quote, it will consult with the AJS before making any approach to colleges or universities to whom we might consider offering our courses. It is understood that such an approach would be limited to those schools, and this was important, which, in the judgment of your association, do not offer and are unlikely in the foreseeable future to offer any program of Jewish studies of their own. So that the question of community and university and academy were those were real questions in the definitions of the time. Now, of course, as we know, that was many, many years ago. AJS today is, at age 40, much more comfortable in his skin, much more comfortable about his identity, and justly proud, I think, of the accomplishments. But there is, in fact, although much changes for the better with middle age, only the December stormy weather is the same of our annual meetings, and a few old and familiar faces that have remained a constant. But certainly this meeting and the quality of this conference is, in fact, a tribute in some ways to those early battles that are so amusing and juvenile in retrospect. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jen. I always think it's important to point out that, of course, all of our colleagues who serve as directors of the organization, as officers, and as president are doing this on a volunteer basis in addition to their very busy lives of teaching and scholarship. And many of the battles, which in retrospect may, you know, seem years later, right, trivial or juvenile, are very, very deeply felt at the time. And many things go on behind the scenes to keep this organization a growing and meaningful one. Thank you. Our next speaker, Lawrence Schiffman, Ethel and Irvin A. Edelman, Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies, Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies, and Chairman of the Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU. Larry works in Dead Sea Scrolls, Jewish Religious, Political, and Social History in Late Antiquity, and the History of Jewish Law and Talmudic Literature. He will address the following question. What do you think are the greatest challenges and opportunities for the AJS in Jewish studies over the next decade?
Okay, thank you very much. Let me begin by pointing out that I wasn't at the first meeting because students weren't allowed in. But I was at the second and have actually just figured out that because of two sabbaticals in Israel, I have been to 37 meetings of the AJS. Now, had I remembered, I would have told them to bring the banner that used to be put up when there were dinners. And unfortunately, the collective history, or perhaps the collective property, has actually been lost. Now, I want to address a question which for me is kind of funny, because I had the opportunity, because of some happy coincidences or because of some good friends who maybe aren't such good friends, to always have the job in AJS that required changing everything. For this reason, and I say this now not humorously, seriously, I had an unbelievable experience as an active person in AJS. So many things that I thought needed to be changed, I got to work on in an effort to change them. And so when I go to a meeting, as I come to this meeting, I look around and I just think it's absolutely fantastic. Not because I did it, on the contrary, because the people that carried on have done such a fantastic job in so many areas that we had to begin to work on as the organization moved from the kind of infancy you heard about into what we might call the modern period. And so for me to tell you now things that I think need to be done is sort of difficult, because the truth is that so many wonderful things have been done. Now, I want to address, however, a series of issues which really have to do with things that could have been done but somehow haven't been done. Now, one of the main things, I know others were supposed to speak about challenges of the past, but one I have to discuss briefly because it relates to a challenge of the future. One of the main problems that we had, and Judith alluded to it a little bit when she spoke about gender studies, was that sometime, I don't know, it must be 15 years ago, the whole field began to change as part of overall changes in, for what most of us is our core area of the humanities in universities. When these changes took place, which I'm not going to attempt to chronicle, and you all know about them, the AJS found itself with a whole slew of new fields coming in. This created a fundamental challenge, which we actually did very well with. And that was the challenge of being able to integrate these without compromising the many important principles that underlie some of these sort of polemical issues that you heard hinted at before. That is to say, we wanted to bring these fields in and let them flourish in AJS without, to be honest, compromises about questions like, do these people know the languages and are they really trained in Judaica? All these issues that our predecessors dealt with. Now, somehow or another, probably because of all of you and because of people who worked on the program, we succeeded. But this now leaves us, ironically, with an issue for the future that I think we have to be concerned with. And I admit that this one is a partly personal one. We have to be exceedingly careful to make sure that we don't see the marginalization, or you might even say continued marginalization, of classical fields and classical forms of research. Because if the AJS were to become disconnected from the people who do Bible and Talmud and medieval and Rambam and all this kind of stuff, if somehow or another the groups were to separate, the terrible transgression against what we feel is a coherent academic field with different periods and different disciplinary approaches would be lost. So one of the main things that I think we have to do in the future is work to secure the future within our organization of areas that admittedly have become minority areas. And this reflects on another thing which has not been our business so far, and that is that for all the areas we work in, we need to begin in AJS to find funding and support for larger projects that don't have a home base anymore in this country because of shifts that have happened on the one hand in the Jewish institutions, on the other hand within the universities towards a lot of these new fields and away from certain traditional fields which are philological or more document-based. We have to make sure that that remains with the proper support, because otherwise all these things will be exported to Israel, which brings me to another point. AJS needs to look carefully at its relationship with Jewish studies in Israel and in Europe. The fact is that while we've been globalized by people coming to our meetings, and while we've gotten to the point where we exchange mailings with things like the World Congress of Jewish Studies and we'll send out information about what they're doing, the fact of the matter is, given the extensive contact between American and Israeli and European scholars of Judaica, we have to begin to take efforts as an organization to encourage this on a grander scale. Now, originally, there was a time when people were worried, does America have its own identity, or are we just some kind of schleppers where the Israelis are the real scholars? This is certainly not the case anymore, and with a degree of self-confidence, we have to begin to make ourselves felt more as an international organization. Now, within our own country, there's been an amazing development, which is that items that have to do with Jews and Judaism have become part of popular culture in the same way that someone might read a National Geographic article or watch a television program about something that is just interesting, like Shakespeare or Chinese culture or something like this. And the fact is that this has opened up for us a role in what is generally called public history. It's a role for many of us as individuals and in our departments, and it's a role, I think, where AJS may want to take a look. Let me put it that way. I'm not ready to put forward programs that cost money, et cetera, but I think that AJS needs to look at what it's doing to be an organization which is an address as things having to do with Jews and Jewish studies become more public and more discussed, because I've been seeing that it's been happening tremendously. Now, one thing that we still haven't succeeded with is this constant discussion about our contacts with colleagues in related disciplines. Now, first of all, we have to stop being apologetic about one thing. We are not parochial and we are not interdisciplinary, okay? That is to say, the group that sits here makes use of all kinds of ancillary fields besides what you could, I don't even know what it means to say besides Judaic studies, because I don't think we would define Judaic studies as being only about Jews somehow and disconnected from other fields. And the point is, though, that even with all of that, the number of us that are constantly frustrated by the existence of courses where Jews and Judaism should be mentioned and they're not mentioned by our colleagues, with the number that are frustrated that the local department of X has a seminar and they don't bother to invite the person who does Jewish stuff because they happen to be in the religion department or something. And I think this is a battle that has to be continued. And no matter what we've done, we have not succeeded in getting people to say, you know, I'm a modern historian. I ought to go to AJS because I deal with ethnic history. So let me go to AJS once in a while. This is not our fault, but we still haven't done it. And I think that we should put effort into it. I have one last thing that I want to address here. And it's a kind of a fear of something I've seen over and over, and especially those of us who train graduate students see it. There are atmospheres in which Professor X will be a great research scholar, but Professor X in another atmosphere will end up not a great research scholar. The truth of the matter is that we have made Judaic studies so extensive in this country that we ought to look around to connect people, and I think here's an area AJS could begin to work in, to connect people who are single practitioners with larger groups so that they would not become disconnected from the ongoing research in the field. There's something about being part of a regular seminar, of meeting people, and I know that many of us who have large programs, and this is especially the case, I think, with universities that are not in the main urban areas, but where there are substantial numbers of Judaic scholars, say 3, 4, 5, or 6, could do something to pick up a person or two that are in the area and say, hey, why don't you participate regularly in seminars with us, in activities with us? Because I see so often, especially when I go to give sometimes far-flung lectures, I meet people that I remember hearing giving a paper 20 years ago, and they gave a wonderful paper, they had a wonderful dissertation, and they have not really continued their research. Now, I've just named a few things, and I think my time is probably up. But I want to conclude by saying the following. One of the things that's really amazing about the AJS is that it's done an unbelievable amount for the field and for its members. And I think that this is something that we have to really be proud of. We do have to understand, and I know that the current leadership of the organization understands this well, that everything is changing in front of us. And I'm not talking about financial issues where we, by the way, had a wonderful report at the board meeting of exceedingly wise planning and handling of our affairs and really very impressive type of discussion. But leave that aside. What I'm saying is that the conditions that have to do with the relationship of us to the American academic scene, the nature of the American academic scene, relation of countries and peoples, these things are all changing right in front of us. And we have weathered previous such changes, and I think that what we want to do is we want to realize that the trick to maintaining everything that we're committed to is changing in the right way. So I would simply leave you with the notion that we have to be on the lookout constantly and try to change and develop in ways that can maximize the great achievements that we've already had. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Our next speaker, Robert Seltzer, professor of history at Hunter College, City University of New York, and works in historiography and Jewish intellectual history. And the question that Bob has chosen to address is, Bob, the majority of past presidents are historians. Please reflect on how that came to be and what that says about the AJS's evolution, identity, and relationship to the traditional disciplines. Thanks.
Well, first, I would actually like to briefly address question 6, okay. Just for a moment.
Tell us what question 6 is.
6, which is, in all your years of attending the AJS meetings, what would you count as the most memorable moment? This is not necessarily the most memorable, but what moment I was standing in front of that room at the Copley Plaza that was decorated like the Venetian courtyard at a plenary session, which Jacob Neusner was invited to speak. And he turned to me and he said, "I'm very nervous." Never forgot that. Surrounded as I am here by scholars who know much more than I do about any conceivable subject in Jewish studies, I know exactly how he felt. Have the majority of past presidents of the AJS been historians? Well, there are eight AJS presidents whom it's easy to classify in that way. Leon Schick, the first president, Jane Gerber, Michael Meyer, Robert Chazen, David Berger, Lauren Schiffman, Judith Baskin, and myself. I think I don't hear any. Their history was mentioned. Then the non-historians are at the most five: Baruch Levine, Nachum Sarna, Arnold Band, Herbert Paper, and Ruth Weiss. But I would put Herb in the historians category, even though his specialty is linguistics, because of his work on the history of the languages of ancient Iran and the history of Yiddish. And if Ruth doesn't mind, I would put her as a historian because of her great work on modern Jewish literary history. So that would actually say that of the 13, only three are not really historians, the two Bible scholars and the literary critic Arnold Band. Looked at from the perspective of the history of Jewish studies in American universities, the majority of AJS historians, presidents, are heirs not of Harry Wolfson of Harvard, Isaac Husik of Penn, Irwin Goodenough of Yale, or Alexander Altman of Brandeis, but, as we heard before, Salo Barone of Columbia. Leon and I, and Jane and Bob, and I presume David, all studied with Barone. And Ruth. Leon and I took the last course he gave before he retired, which I got a B, but it's too late to impeach me. Ruth, although her PhD is from McGill, you went to Columbia as well. So therefore, I would say that if you want to be president of the AJS, you should have gone to Columbia. Head of a Jewish studies program or a Jewish studies department is a very good qualification as well. What about going to rabbinical school? Leon Schick, Michael Meyer, and I attended HUC-JIR. Bob Chazen and I assume Baruch Levine went to JTS. David and Larry went to Yeshiva. Then that cuts me down. Oh, David went to Yeshiva. A majority of the 13 went to rabbinical school, although I think we could say that that will be less and less the case in the future years, and more as the venue of Jewish studies has already shifted to secular institutions. That is probably very much out of date. Why so many presidential historians? I propose that history was, and perhaps still is, the matrix that renders Jewish studies coherent and gives it a definite place in the university curriculum. We explain, of course, to our students that the word Elohim may be plural grammatically, but when it refers to the God of Israel, it takes a singular verb. Jewish studies is plural grammatically, but what makes it singular, in more ways than one, is that it is about a singular heritage of more than 3,000 millennia that has flourished in almost every corner of the globe and in every continent of the world at one time or another, and has intersected with so many levels of many histories of the great civilizations. In the heyday of the close connection between Wissenschaft des Judentums and the modernizing movements in Jewish religious and later secular thought, each one of them produced a master historical narrative, a narrative that defined the parameters who pushed backward of Jewish studies and forward, and they did it in an age when becoming was put at the heart of being. And that recovering so many forgotten aspects of the Jewish past, it was history that restored the intellectual coherence of the Jewish tradition in relation to modern canons of investigation and criticism. We probably all recall Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi's famous pronouncement in Zahor: history became what it had never been before, the faith of fallen Jews. As I see it, the validity behind his bon mot is that the study of Jewish history provided many ardent Jews a way of making sense of the increasing complexity and multidimensionality of the Judaic heritage as it was unfolded through their research and reconstructed in time. To change my metaphor, history provided the big picture in which we could fit what I think Marcia Rosenblatt was referring to when she said the traditional disciplines, Bible, rabbinics, Jewish philosophy, mysticism, Jewish literature, maybe Jewish sociology and anthropology as well. What gave them the coherence was that they became part of this new and expanding concept of history. Now, to fast forward to the era in which we've mentioned several times when the AJS was founded. The AJS was the result of itself of the increasing acceptance of Jewish studies in the curriculum of American higher education, and also, as Bob said, quite deliberately, a means to ensure that that this would take place on a high professional level. Then came this great efflorescence of Jewish studies and the concomitant resizing of the association under David, Larry, and Judy, and Aaron Katchen, and especially Rhoda Sharamane. They nationalized the movement and led it to the impressive scope that it has now. A perusal of the booklets of recent years is one indication that Jewish studies have, in the plural, become integral to the academic community. And it is indicative as well of the invisible dimensions, hitherto invisible, brought to light by our members in the whole range of the humanities, the arts, and the social sciences. And the papers that we hear every year, especially this year, themselves indicate to the extent to which the greater conceptual sophistication and the freshness of methodological perspective and refined source analysis have brought our understanding of so many aspects of Jewish studies to light. But the owl of Minerva flies only at night, and in my opinion, history will remain the queen of the Jewish Wissenschaften, but it is a chastened history, a history that serves as the frame of that Judaic tapestry of multicolored and many-textured threads, showing already we're beginning to see new Jewish comprehensive histories written by Ray Scheinland, David Beale, or edited, Michael Satlow, John Efron and his group. And I think the newest Jewish history that is coming up to be will be full of loose ends, interconnections, contradictions, reversals, leaps, tensions. But Judaism exists in the dimension of time, so that the traditional and the new disciplines may well be continued to be subsumed under an all-embracing historical chronology. Therefore, I expect that we'll have a plethora of Jewish historians around from which to elect future presidents of the AJS.
Thank you. Our next speaker, Ruth Weiss, is a Harvard College professor, Martin Peretz professor of Yiddish literature, and professor of comparative literature. Works in comparative and Yiddish literature, or should we say the history of Yiddish literature. And her question is, we're asking, Ruth, what would you say are the distortions in Jewish studies as a field, perhaps neglect of certain subjects or methodological approaches, overemphasis on others, and their causes?
I was a little skeptical about this panel because I would have wanted to hear every one of these speakers speak for the whole time. But I must say that it's been fascinating for me, and I'm glad to get everybody, and we can continue this conversation, hopefully. I'll begin with my angle. The same year that the Association for Jewish Studies was founded at Brandeis, I talked the English department at McGill University into letting me offer courses in Yiddish literature instead of the sections of English literature survey that I had been teaching on my way to the PhD. I argued that the university pretended to teach Western civilization. You see, I was always non-confrontational and polite. I argued that the university pretended to teach Western civilization, but actually that it neglected one of its key components. Judaism was at the heart of Western civilization, and the recent destruction of the Jews in Europe was but one of the many evidentiary proofs of its ongoing relevance. Yiddish literature might not seem the most obvious point of entry for the teaching of Jewish civilization, but since there was not then at McGill any unit on the Jews, in any course on the entire curriculum, let alone any full course on Jewish history, language, literature, culture, philosophy, ancient, medieval, or modern, Yiddish literature was as good a starting point as any other. And in fact, I argued that it was an excellent starting point. After some negotiation, the department accepted my proposal, and it is interesting to note for the historians that the only person who voted against it was the only Jewish member of the department, an American who had recently come up to escape the draft. I didn't know about the AJS, and I didn't know any of the people involved in its founding. I learned about the organization from a McGill professor of philosophy, Harry Bracken, incidentally not a Jew, who had become independently interested in the Jewish contribution to British philosophy, which was his field, and he had heard about the AJS from an American colleague. We drove down from Montreal to Waltham together for the second annual conference, and I became a member and started coming ever since. In those early years, as you have heard, there was only one set of sessions at a time, so one had the chance to learn about much that was going on in the field. I really wish I could linger on those early years, but I mention them here just to get, at least in part, to the question that's been put to me. My own academic background was very different from most of the founding members of the AJS, who, as you heard, have come out, many of them had come out of seminaries, and almost all of them had classical training in Jewish sources. By contrast, I'd studied literature in the literature departments of Columbia University and McGill. The founders of the AJS seemed to me very eager to prove themselves to two sets of people. First and foremost, to the Gedolim, who had been their teachers and models, people like Louis Finkelstein and Louis Ginzburg and Harry Wolfson and Selo Baron, and also to prove themselves to the American Council of Learned Societies, of which they wanted AJS to become a member. They were concerned with standards, and in the early years, incidentally, it has not been mentioned, members were required to learn Hebrew. We didn't know how we were going to enforce that, but that was really a requirement. Not that anyone tested us, but that was it. And the prospect of ACLS membership came up year after year until it finally happened. I came at the profession from exactly the opposite direction. I was far less concerned about proving the standards of Jewish studies than I was about testing the standards of the university, which had not satisfied my ideal of a genuine quest for truth. With the exception of the Weinreichs, Max and Uriel, who were my teachers, and a single course with Selah Baron, I was mostly self-taught in Jewish studies at the advanced level, and I stood in a somewhat adversarial rather than respectful relation to the American and Canadian Academy, whose parochialism I had experienced through my entire college and university career. The Jewish tradition, as I knew it from the inside, was intellectually open. I knew this from Yiddish itself, which had always fearlessly absorbed elements from other languages, taking huge delight in this integrative process. There was nothing in Yiddish to parallel the attempt of German and French language academies to protect them from foreign influence, and language is certainly one of the most essential ways of knowing a people. And in many other ways, I found Jewish culture much bolder, intellectually much more penetrating than what I discovered in the English tradition. I thought that the pedagogic approach of the Jewish day schools that I had attended prepared me far better for the life of the mind than the Protestant high school I had attended or the English Protestant and French Catholic universities of Montreal, where my husband and I had studied. So I was certain that Jewish studies had much to offer the academy. And at one point, I even tried the department, tried to get the Department of English to introduce a Chavruta model of learning based on what I dimly knew about yeshiva education. Moreover, I felt that as a Jew, I had been an engaged witness to the most extraordinary sequence of events in human history. In the same decade that the final solution had effectively ended Jewish life in Europe, Jews reconstituted their homeland in the land of Israel, began gathering in some of the world's most damaged refugees. I felt that the law of return was the world's first universal immigration law, since anyone who genuinely wished to could become a Jew. Clearly, I felt, Jews had crafted a political way of life very different from other nations. And incidentally, my impression of this difference was by no means celebratory alone. When people asked me about Yiddish, I often said that what I studied was the history of Jewish mistakes. And in fact, one of the most recent articles I've written is about Jewish informers, Moisrim, of which Yiddish offers many varieties if you just want to know the vocabulary. The Roidef, the Oisgeber, the Farkloger, the Zutroger, the Chantagist, the Messirnik, the Bilbulnik, the Farloimter, the Paschkvilant, the Yabednik, Fareter, Sipak, Grebcher, Donoschik. This is just to mention some of them. And you understand that these terms refer to informers from within and against their own communities. It's not a pleasant subject, perhaps, but it's one that goes with the lack of territory. My point is that Judaism and the Jews had charted a unique path, and those differences were manifest in Jewish history, so that scholars of Jewish studies who wanted to be true to their subject had to be prepared to recognize some of those differences and to resist the Me Too-ism of the academy, precisely if they wanted to take a comparative approach. So here is where I feel that we have not done our job totally. We've done a fantastic job, as I think everybody here recognizes. Individually, I have to say, I'm grateful for almost everything that I read and discover in Jewish studies. I've rarely attended a talk or read anything which has not contributed in some way to my knowledge and to my thinking. But collectively, I think that we've accepted uncritically some theories, approaches, vocabularies, and emphases that distort rather than illuminate Jewish realities. I think politics in particular has been the most understudied aspect of Jewish studies, the part of Jewish experience that most impacted other nations, yet that Jewish studies has shied away from, maybe because of its exceptionalism. We have not asked political science, comparative government, political history to integrate the Jews into its thinking. We've allowed Middle East studies to take its cues from those who think that studying others is a form of domination rather than what it is, an impulse of genuine interest and generous accommodation. I think that we've tried very hard to show all the ways in which Jewishness is liminal and malleable and boundary crossing and pluralistic, sometimes to the point of making Jews the zealot among nations. So let me just end with two observations, and I don't mean the first one to be contentious, although I don't know how to frame it so that it will not sound that way. I think it's Judaism itself that broke away from the pack, and Jews who resisted the universalizing impulse that tempts people in every generation to identify themselves as universalists, whether it be through Christianity or socialism or liberalism or multiculturalism. All of these are wonderful people with wonderful impulses who want to merge and who fear the ideas of differentiation and particularly of chosenness. But Jewishness is the alternative way of life. And so those who seek alternative forms of Jewishness are usually returning in one way or another to the majority or to the trendy elite's idea of the prevailing good. And the current university culture is overwhelmingly liberal and universalistic. To be a Jewish Jew goes against the grain. So clearly the majority of Jewish studies academicians are also going to be liberal, and they are going to want to share the prevailing preference for, you know, all together now, all together now, all together now, you know, rather than for cultural separatism. But I think that we do an intellectual disservice to our subject if we fail to respect the extraordinary lengths the Jews went to remain a people apart. And so I think that the challenge of Jewish studies is to respect and to teach the separateness of Jewishness, ultimately, and why that matters, even if, and maybe especially if, we don't choose to maintain that separateness to the same degree, or even if we don't accept that separateness at all. And my second and briefer observation has to do with something common to many aspects of the academic profession. namely its tendency to get caught up in detail and to miss the big picture. We all chose Jewish studies, I think, because we were drawn in some way to something much larger than ourselves, this amazing history, this amazing culture, this amazing polity, this amazing civilization. So I hope that we will be able to generate new approaches, methodologies, a critical vocabulary to interpret our subjects even better than we have already been doing. And as Larry rightly said, take it out of ourselves and bring it to others so that they understand what, you know, what we have and what we are offering in our studies. People want to know from us, I think, why Jewishness matters. And I hope that we'll be up to the task. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our final past president who will speak tonight is David Berger, who is now the dean of the Bernard Revell Graduate School of Jewish Studies and Ruth and I. Lewis Gordon Professor of Jewish History. And I believe you're going to respond to the third also. Is that correct?
I had no...
Okay, I'm just given this information.
Yeah, I was completely unable to decide. And so I said, I'll talk about whatever question you assign to me. Since there were five questions and six speakers, I was asked to talk about questions five and three, which are primarily five, so I'll repeat it for you. What would you say are the, quote, distortions, unquote, in Jewish studies as a field, parentheses, neglect of certain subjects or methodological approaches, overemphasis on others, close parentheses, and their causes, e.g., changing scholarly fashions generally and resistance to these fashions within Jewish studies, changing skill sets of Jewish studies scholars, and so forth. All right, that was the question. And then question three was the future. Was the future. Time is up is right. So anyway, this is my punishment. So that I will address things that have been addressed, and there will be some similarity, which I suppose may be a good thing, because there is, we just heard from a Yiddish professor, there is an old Yiddish expression that as megeita fagleiche weg, trefft man sich mit Menschen. If you go on a straight path, you meet people. And so, although I once saw a plaque that said, "Al teilech baderech hara'a, tzafuf sham," but anyway, it's a commonplace that Jewish studies, the field of Jewish studies, lags behind in utilizing cutting-edge trends in the field. I once wrote that one advantage of commonplaces is that they are usually true. In this case, maybe that's a disadvantage. But sometimes lagging behind is not so terrible. Moshe Rossman, who is here, I think, he was here today, wrote a justly celebrated book addressing the issue of postmodernism or whatever other term you would like to use, and Jewish history. Someone who got a PhD within the last 2 years and is a Jewish historian, told me that he didn't understand why people would, in the field were so excited by this, since he had just come out of a program where he was exposed to this sort of thing in general history courses. But I have to say that the fact that this book has aroused the interest that it has is a testimony at least to the receptivity of Jewish studies to addressing these approaches, and to the degree that the book seems less innovative than it might be, I think that is precisely because it is so sensible. There is a disconnect between a radical skepticism, whatever label you give it, and the actual practice of scholarship, at least in history. You can't do history while really applying the most radical version of postmodernists, deconstructionists, whatever terms, many other terms that you might want to use. New fields have been absorbed by Jewish studies, and in the long run, it doesn't matter that much if they are absorbed in the first year or in the fifth year. sub specie aeternitatis. This is of, I really think it's of little moment. I remember that reading Marion Kaplan's 1998 book about Jews in Nazi Germany ended any resistance I may have had to recognizing the value of gender analysis, which doesn't mean that I am able to incorporate it in my own creative research. I should also add that generalizations about Jewish studies are problematic. Jewish studies is not the same from institution to institution or from country to country. In the early days of AJS, as Larry said, the Israeli academic establishment looked upon American Jewish scholarship with no small degree of disdain. That is in large measure not true anymore, though I don't think it has disappeared entirely. On the other hand, such attitudes can be turned back in the other direction. Jacob Neusner, but also others, argued quite vigorously that Israel lags behind the United States in the application of new methodologies regarding the study of Talmud. Here I'd like to say something that is similar to what Larry said, and that is that sometimes one has to resist the denigration of the allegedly old-fashioned. I recently read a grant evaluation of a doctoral dissertation being written in Israel in which the evaluator, who was an American scholar, said that you shouldn't support this dissertation in Talmud because it involves the close analysis of texts and will not interest more than a dozen people. I don't say that if you're comparing two dissertations and you have to decide which one to support, that you should not perhaps consider the breadth of interest. But this was an evaluation that was not comparative. To say that this sort of scholarship is not worthy of support is, I think, very problematic. I worry about the dilution of the expectation that Jewish studies scholars in general have command of Hebrew and familiarity with classical texts. On one level, the situation has improved greatly since the early days of American Jewish scholarship, although certainly the founders of AJS, as we've heard, had such command to the nth degree. Embracing the novel can lead to the sense that old-fashioned skills are unnecessary. And here I'd like to say two things. I'd like to make reference to two dissertations that bothered me. I will not identify the topic. I will not identify the author. I will not identify the institution. I want to make a point. And I understand very well that you don't make a point usually by citing two examples. But in this case, I think that they teach us something we need to worry about at least a little bit. A very recently published book, was based on a dissertation written about a decade ago in a premier university, which is on a Jewish studies topic, a quintessential Jewish studies topic. It was written by a person patently unqualified to do it, full of egregious errors that would have been caught by the advisor had he been even minimally conscientious. The purported value of the work was that it saw the Jewish topic in the context of the larger environment and with the use of new methodological tools. The published version contains all the errors of the original and more. That means that that both referees of books and supervisors of dissertations needs to be much more, they need to be conscientious. Maybe you will tell me, and I guess you will be right, that this is a case of excessive defensiveness, because such things can happen in any field. But in the field of Jewish studies, to the degree that at least I am still somewhat insecure about how we are viewed, these concerns are particularly acute. With that, I go to a very related issue regarding the degree to which scholars in other fields recognize the value of Jewish studies. They recognize it far more than they did in the olden days. That there is no question. I'll give you one illustration of something that happened before AJS was founded. When I had my Woodrow Wilson interview, the first question that I got, which was intended as a friendly question, was, you have been studying Jewish subjects since the first grade. What do you expect to learn about Jewish history in graduate school that you do not already know? I wanted to say, and I really thought of this at the time, you know, usually you think of, at least I think of good answers later. This time I actually thought of it right away, but I wanted to get the fellowship, so I didn't say it. What I wanted to say was, did you ever ask this question of someone who said that he or she wants to study American history in graduate school? And the answer, of course, is that this person, there's no way this person ever asked that question. Similarly, a little bit later than that, in the early to mid-70s, the American Historical Review published a review of a book about French Jewry. It was a collective volume. One of the essays there dealt with the Middle Ages, and the reviewer wrote that the great 11th century Jewish scholar Rashi wrote most of his works in French because Jews, even learned Jews, could not read Hebrew. I wrote a letter to AHR, not for publication, because I wanted to lose my temper, asking whether they could imagine a sentence like that in which Aquinas was substituted for Rashi, and learned Christians were substituted for Jews, and Latin was substituted for Hebrew. So again, I turn to a recent dissertation, this one written outside the field of Jewish studies. It was in medieval, is in the field of medieval studies, but there's a chapter on Rashi, which is not merely beneath contempt, but far beneath contempt. And that means that the people who sponsored this dissertation, who are not in the field of Jewish studies, did not think it necessary to have a Jewish studies expert involved in taking a look at a chapter written about Rashi, which means that there is a sense that somehow or other, you know, this is a field where you can knock off a chapter about Rashi without any expertise among the people who read this dissertation. In light of this, I am still a little bit uneasy about the standing of Jewish studies in the eyes of some of our colleagues in other fields, it means that we have to make the efforts that were already discussed. We need to maintain contact with people in related fields, invite them to our conferences and to our departmental events, expose our students to the issues engaging cutting-edge scholars without sacrificing the textual skills and deep learning that still play a key role in making Jewish studies a field that commands or should command respect. At this point, mysterious question six said that we were allowed to take an extra 2 minutes to talk about the most memorable moment that we had in AJS. So I will take the 2 minutes to give you a series of lighthearted, memorable moments. First, one relevant today, I learned about the suggestibility, even of scholars, when in the Copley Plaza Hotel on Hanukkah, they used to actually set up candles and have a fire marshal sitting there. They did it 1 year. They knew they're supposed to do this when it was not Hanukkah. And I then passed by the table, and there were at least 6 or 7 people who had lit candles. That's one story. A second story, a more scholarly one, at one of those Harvard early conferences, I learned the following, and I think about this every year on a certain Jewish holiday. There was a converso monk in the 1480s in Spain, and an internal investigation determined that this converso monk got sick every September or October, and his Jewish physician, this is before the expulsion, would come to examine him and prescribe fresh air, so that a sukkah was built in the courtyard of the monastery every sukkahs. And finally, when I was a program chair, some of you have heard me tell this story before. When I was program chair, first of all, you should know that the conference program didn't always look the way it does now. I mean, one of my great achievements as program chair was that running heads were put into the program so that when you looked at a session, you knew what day it was. But there were two abstracts that didn't fit with anything else in the conference, but they were by excellent scholars and they were excellent abstracts. One by Chava Weisler was entitled something like Jewish Cemetery Prayers for Deceased Members of the Family. And the other one was by Mordechai Akiva Friedman entitled Killer Wife Motif, which was later published in AJS in Jewish Law. And it was a great paper. These were both excellent, excellent scholars with excellent papers, but they didn't fit with anything else. And so one of my most enjoyable moments in AJS was when I came to the session that I had created, which consisted of these two papers, and watched the people have fun. I entitled it Posthumous Perspectives on Jewish Family Life.
Well, as is inevitable, we have gone over time, and I think we will pass on the other 2 minutes for memorable moments and for questions and simply say thank you very much to all of our participants. Thank you.
Been a person since the leadership.